you're listening to Cadence, a podcast for creatives. I'm Hafsa.
And I'm Yen.
And if you're new to the podcast, Cadence is a conversation around topics that we wish we'd been more informed on when we started out on our career paths. The hope is to arm you, the listener, with some takes and some tips that might be of service as you venture out on your own unique path. And also just to have a fun conversation with some fantastic people.
We definitely want to give a shout out to Fifth Avenue Studios for providing this beautiful space. And we are so grateful for the collaboration and the ability to produce this podcast in this space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Always so nice and quiet and cool in here. I came in from kind of a warm day, so it's kind of nice to have some air conditioning happening.
Our guest today is Lisa Sauvé.
So excited.
She's the principal, CEO, and co-founder of Synecdoche, an award-winning design and making interdisciplinary studio in Ann Arbor and Detroit. She is also the founder of Do Good Work, a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to support creatives with resources and placemaking strategies towards a strong and inclusive social, economic, and cultural fabric of our community. Lisa co-founded Studio Studio, a modern venue and co-working space for creatives and photographers on Packard next to York. And she teaches at Tubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at University of Michigan. She has been named Crain's Detroit Notable Women in Design in 2020 and 2021, recognized by Forbes Next 1000, AIA Michigan Young Architect Award, and U of M Tubman College Outstanding Recent Graduate. Lisa is a licensed architect in the state of Michigan and served as the planning commissioner for the city of Ann Arbor for the past 5 years. She holds degrees in Masters of Architecture and in Science in Conservation from Tubman College at the University of Michigan and a BS in Architecture from Lawrence Technical University. And I know some of your spaces, including Sweet Heather Ann, Bellflower, Homes Campus and Dozer, Studio Studio, Bamboo. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Classics.
So welcome, Lisa. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be with both of you.
This is fantastic. No, you were one of really high on our list when we were kind of looking at different guests for our show because, you know, we're really looking for creatives and people who are like creative adjacent. Like I think I know you through Pete Baker. Like you did some work with Duo Security and the offices there. And like, you just have this really broad sort of portfolio of not just skill sets, but these considerations and these community connections that I think are so important for people to know about, especially as they move into this kind of realm. So thank you for joining us today.
I'm excited. Thank you.
And I was also thinking about how I know you, and I honestly don't remember because we've never actually partnered or overlapped on anything formally.
Right.
But I think that as we were talking about these circles and networks and movements in our immediate community, like we kind of circle around the same kinds of thinking and doing. And so, do you remember how we met?
I don't.
I honestly don't.
It might have like Omari days.
Maybe.
If they were like, back when Omar, one of those like avalanche neutral zone sort of activities.
Maybe.
I imagine that's like, it's probably some early event like that. But
yeah.
I think overall, the two of you, you know, conversations just in the community with members talking about ideas. Mm. There are certain names that always bubble up, and the two of you are there.
Yeah.
Same.
So, in the web.
It's just in the aura of the community.
Absolutely.
For sure.
So, Lisa, we always love to delve into how did you get here? Like, what was little Lisa doing that said, someday, I'm going to be building this, and I'm going to be making these beautiful spaces for people to inhabit?
Yeah. It's... I guess I am a unique one in that I knew I wanted to be an architect as maybe one of my roles and titles that I have since I was a kid.
Wow.
And yeah, maybe like it developed over time, but it all really started. And my dad just gave this poster to me a couple of years ago when I actually told him the story, when I really connected a lot of these dots together. But he worked for Apple way back in the 80s, early Apple days when he was like selling at Computerland and kind of sales. But part of one of the swag of the day was a poster by Matt Groening.
Oh.
Of
I think
Bongo's Dream Dorm.
Yeah.
And it's like this exploded X. So the walls are removed and there's, it's just a huge, amazing space of things going on. And so I would just get lost in it. Mm. And then I took a drafting class in middle school and then was lucky enough to have. Yeah. So I took typing, cooking, drafting. And I forget what the fourth class
was.
Where did
you go to school?
Yeah. So it was like this four that everybody was required to take in Pinckney. So bright red Pinckney.
Not just down the street.
Cool. Yeah. And then in high school, the school was also a magnet school to teach the CAD program. So other high schools would come over. And so I took that for 3 years. And by the end, I was like, yep, I'm going to go to Lawrence Tech. I'm going to go to U of M. Check, check, check. And I did the thing. But then really reflecting on it, was like, I thought it was from curriculum, but really figuring out how did I stick with it?
Yes.
It was really getting lost in just like the cartoon and imagination world as well. And somehow I stuck through it. I think part of it is almost a sunk cost, maybe, right? Architecture is a long slog. But very early in that formal path, I also had my kid, Amy. So my sophomore year, I took some time off, had my daughter.
Extra pops to you.
So it was really unplanned. It was unplanned that Amy would even come home with me. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things kind of changed on the fly, took the semester off, but came back in the fall and just kind of continued pursuing it. And I think a lot of times architecture, you see a big drop off, especially women, if you map the kind of career paths within their 30s, because that's when family and what architects are typically compensated, the balance of, you know, salary and raising a family and paying for daycare all really fall off.
Yeah.
And again, so myself as a single mom raising a kid, it was really impossible for me graduating in 2009 from undergrad to go get a summer internship at an architecture firm and pay for daycare.
Yeah.
So that's where like Synecdoche came in as we found our first project on Craigslist.
Nice.
Formed an LLC.
Craigslist.
And was just started doing some weird stuff on our own before like technically licensed the smaller scale work, either residential or, you know, interiors type work doesn't require that license. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like slipping into these cracks within the field that allowed you to practice without all of that, the extra credentials.
Right.
And just building from there.
I love that. So it was almost formed out of necessity.
Absolutely.
What I'm
yep.
Wow.
And in 2009.
In 2009.
Before, I feel like the, I don't know exactly what point the internet kind of hit its apex, but I wouldn't say it was in 2009. I mean, sure, we all had websites and things that looked glossy, but yeah. So how did you grow that? How did that come to what it is now?
Yeah. So I like another side story. When I say we founded it, it's with my partner, Adam, who I met the following year when I came back to school after taking that time off with Amy. We had studio together, really clicked and started working on academic projects together. Somehow I convinced Adam to do this Craigslist project with me. And from there, I mean, we were really excited to build work. This was also a time, so 2009, right? We're in a recession. The building industry is really not happening. And so a lot of architects, they also do like competitions. And so speculative like paperwork where it's like big ideas that get published and there's award money. Cool. That's kind of what keeps lights on or whatever. But for us, we said we want to do one built project a year. Didn't matter the size. And so that was just our baseline. And at the same time, we went to grad school. So we had something else going on.
Wow.
So Synecdoche for several years was just that goal of one built project a year to build enough portfolio and experience to then be able to do this thing full time.
Right.
Because typically you go work for an architecture firm, design projects, and get to oversee construction and see how the process goes alongside another professional that has more experience than you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We were just learning on the job with no mentor, you know. So I think that was part of it too, is like going at a pace simultaneous to more education, gig economy and things like this, just to get it built up.
Would you kind of say that you were, I mean, it sounds like you're sort of learning on the job in a way, because if you're not, you know, in that sort of traditional environment where you get to have that mentor and tutelage and whatnot, then you really are just kind of going out on your own and kind of figuring things out and learning like what process works best for you, what aesthetic works best for you, what design sensibility, like what was sort of that process there? Or was it just literally like, we're just going to do it, figure it out?
Design as a process, right, is iterative for you. And there's never one solution. So I think it was just working on projects and expecting every project to be a prototype itself. Like the final product is also a prototype at the same time. You know, that we're trying things out. We're having clients that are taking a risk on us. Of course, we're like cheap and like we're very upfront. Like we're not licensed architects, but we're going to build it and put all the sweat equity into it. Yeah. Like we're invested in this thing because this is our launching pad too. And so, yeah, it's like you're learning not just the skills, you're learning how to develop the skills. And I think that's a big thing where if I was working in an architecture office, they would tell me how to do things.
Sure.
And having to go through different iterations, figuring out your own how, I think was a big thing for us. Like we knew what we needed to do. Like we need to figure out a wall detail.
Yeah.
How we figure that out? Do we do a mock-up? Do we go look at other examples? Do we ask three different contractors? Do we go to the library? Like there's a lot of different paths to get that answer. And so we started crafting our own process.
I feel like I'm just going to spend this whole episode saying wow, because there are so many aspects to architecture that are about safety and not just the aesthetic and the design, but also like the client management and satisfaction.
Right.
If we early on, how did you know what to pull in terms of licenses administratively, like the bureaucracy of the process of building within a home? Certainly you don't have to be licensed, but there must have been a ton of hoops to jump through.
Yes. And I think that's where, like, while we weren't working in a firm, so I have never worked in an architecture firm. Adam had a couple of internships and have seen a few different processes. But a few of our faculty, especially at Lawrence Tech when we were really getting going, one knew that we were doing this first job and said, do you have a contract? Let me give you a draft of a contract, right? Mm-hmm. Another faculty who had an office was like, if you ever get to the point that you need an architect to review your drawings for permit and stamp, like, call me. You're going to need an architect of record has to work parallel. And so we got started with this small, you know, community of collaboration instead of competition, because it could have been, oh, these young guns are going to come and take our small jobs, especially when the economy's doing nothing in 09. And instead they were like, as architects, we have an ethical responsibility to protect life, safety and welfare. Right. And so for those practitioners too, they knew what we were doing and were like, we need to make sure you're doing it safe as well. We're going to protect you, which means we're going to protect the clients and any of users of the space. And so that kind of paying it forward, making sure that only quality design gets made, has just been something that we then have been pushing forward, that we've tried to welcome non-licensed architects and say, there are a lot of different paths. It's not as linear as it looks to be structured. How can we help other creatives kind of move into this space without feeling like there's huge hurdles to certification and things, while still maintaining that all that safety and the logistics and code and things.
Right. Collaboration, not competition.
Yeah, I love that. And that's support too. I feel like that's a little bit unique maybe in some industries, but I love hearing that there's that sort of that shared responsibility of like, we want you to succeed. We want to make sure that what you're doing is done safely and that the client is well supported. And we're going to help you to get there with that. I want to dig a little bit too into sort of like the design practice side of what you do. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what is sort of the design language of Synecdoche and how did that come about?
I think from the similar, like using what we have. And so it was like very low budget projects. What can we get done? So the first project that we did, it was just a bunch of sheets of plywood from Home Depot. We drilled a bunch of holes in it by hand. Nice. And those perforations became diffusers for really cheap fluorescent lights that were already in the ceiling, became a screen for at the windows. And then we made a bunch of plywood furniture, right? Mm-hmm. So it was like, just buy a pallet of plywood, low budget, hand tools, and this is what you can make out of it. Nice. And so, and the idea that with a low budget, but you want to do something right. unique and creative,
yeah.
you're going to have to put in the work
sure.
to realize that thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a constant tendency with Synecdoche is we're part of the realization of the work. We're not just drawing on the page and then handing it off. Mm. And so we've got a fabrication shop too.
Okay.
Right. Now we've tooled up and we have like a CNC, some metal work. But again, it's not like a really robust and intricate fabrication shop. Mm. Just some woodworking and metalworking things. And so I think a lot of like the aesthetic and processes, very simple materials.
Mm-hmm. Practical kind of use cases.
Durable, that we can easily sourced. Mm-hmm. So we're not trying to get any sort of unique woods or, you know, mm-hmm. stone or stuff that takes specialty materials. Sure. Because we want to show that with fundamentals and basics, you can make unique and beautiful mm-hmm. solutions. It doesn't take big budgets and like wild techniques mm-hmm. to get there. Just a creative mind.
That really describes the sensibility of when I'm standing in line at Dozer.
I know. Yeah.
I love the angles, the lines, mm-hmm. the light. But like you said, it's very
steel
sensible.
Too. Yeah. From down the street at Alro and some OSB sheets, right?
Yeah.
That's
not
all it
like
is.
Marble and granite all the tiles and things. Gosh. Right.
Yep. And it's as little as possible. I think that's like a big thing for like mm-hmm. the concrete slab floor. That's it. We didn't need to put flooring on top of it because
mm-hmm. yeah.
at some point, we also know these small businesses, they rotate, they move around. Exactly. And if you renovate this, it all ends up in a dumpster.
Right.
And that's just not a responsibility. Like, we want to make things beautiful for the time that they exist.
Yeah.
But the world is a longer timeline than any one of these projects. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our responsibility, too.
It's like the social and the natural responsibility. Yep.
Absolutely.
It's like, how do you keep this accessible and how do you make it safe for everyone, for the environment and long lasting?
Yep. And you want the businesses to be sustainable. Yeah. So don't spend all their money up front, right?
Yes. It's not cheap, fast, or good. Not all. What is that? Oh, yeah. 2 out of 3 or something?
2 out of 3, yeah.
There's no typical day. But what could a day look like for you? And how much of that is spent outward facing with your team?
Yeah, all over the place. I mean, so Synecdoche is kind of the foundation that I've branched myself out into a lot of different areas. And so my typical day isn't working on projects, right? Like the idea of I work on the business, not in the business. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at. So working on the business, it's all that business development and finding projects or new opportunities or where we're going to grow or a new direction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that then means engaging the community mm-hmm. with clientele and like where there are needs that we might be the solution. So my typical day could be a nonprofit board meeting mm-hmm. and teaching, having a client meeting, mm-hmm. and then checking in with my bookkeeper. Sort of thing, right? Like that is a pretty typical day. And it's like when I'm spending time in a client meeting, I take the kind of external ear mm-hmm. in our process. I think our team spends a lot of time, you know, filtering a lot of the ideas into like, okay, how does architecture or design make a solution? Mm. But I come from the external side to say, what is their problem? Where are they coming from? How are we understanding that need? Because a lot of, you know, it's one of the things like Ford, if ever they'd get faster horses instead of a car.
Right.
And I think that that's part of where my job is translating to be like, you guys, we need to design a car, mm-hmm. not make these horses faster sort of thing. That's the bridge that I'm in.
Yeah.
Somewhere between advocating for what how the built environment can maybe solve some of these problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of my community work. Mm-hmm. Not everything is spatial.
Right.
But when it is, it can be really impactful. And so helping communities understand like when spatial investment might benefit their mm-hmm. mission. And then simultaneously, the same thing for typical clients that we work with.
And this is very much sort of the tactical work, mm-hmm. right? The tactical work of running a business. And so I want to, just for our audience, you know, because I know a lot of people who listen might, you know, not yet be in that place where, you know, they're far enough ahead to say, oh, yeah. I'm a manager, or I'm able to, you know, lead production of something. So I guess for you, my question is, like, at what point did you feel comfortable in your career of moving from, you know, working more in the business to this more sort of tactical position that yeah. you're in?
I mean, being a founder of the thing, it mm-hmm. was always that, but it's like thinking of the business as a design problem itself, mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. is one way that we are our own client. So instead of being like, I have to run the business and I don't get to design, mm-hmm. I just treat it as another design project that I get to be a part of, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Because I get to design how we want to run meetings or what sort of deliverables mm-hmm. we want to prepare or present or pursue, right? Like, we think design solutions are about simple materials mm-hmm. and details and accessible space. That's a design problem in itself, right. to design that process mm-hmm. across multiple projects. Right. And that's what I get to do instead of figuring out how that filters into one project. Mm-hmm. And so at the same, you know, it's almost like consulting or something else. It's like, how do you make that thing scalable?
Right.
And so if you're, you know, from a starting position as a young designer, it's like taking a single project that you might be working on and understanding, if I scaled this process up, would that process fit into mm-hmm. multiple problems? Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely.
And so that's the way to kind of exchange that scale, mm-hmm. Even no matter what you're handed.
Yeah. I love that you frame it that way, because and this reminds me a little bit of what we were talking about with high-end too, around just, I guess, planning and sort of that fundamental piece of, you know, trying to set not just a client up for success, but set yourself up for success.
Yep.
And so really tackling things, like if you look at things as more of a design problem to solve, where it's like, this is a thing that I want to do. I don't yet know how to accomplish it, but I can set myself up in a way that I can do it successfully at a larger scale at different points in time versus mm-hmm. just thinking about where I am now. Because I think a lot of people can kind of get stuck in that now, right? Like, yep. I don't know how to do it. I don't know where to go from here. But you can kind of learn that just by kind of kicking the can and knocking your head and knocking your hand against the door and figuring things out. Yeah.
I like I think we all get excited at the beginning of design, yes. right? The world mm-hmm. is just open and you get to throw everything out.
Sparkles.
But I think the debrief of like what went wrong mm-hmm. and how to not make the same mistake twice, that's where mm-hmm. you're doing the research again to collect yeah. a robust amount of information and to say, now, how do I design my process mm-hmm. instead of the project? And so I think like the debrief, we always like walk, you know, move past pretty quickly right. to move on to the next project. But itself is so much rich mm-hmm. content for your own design project, your own career as a design project, or your mm-hmm. own business as a design project. So.
And that reflection is scary.
Oh, yeah.
Again, but yeah.
The self-assessment.
Ooh.
Yeah. Looking How many inwards. People are on your team?
There's 5 of us right now.
Uh-huh.
We've ebbed and flowed between 3 to 13-ish.
Okay.
So it really kind of depends. I think the interesting thing for us is I don't have a lot of ambitions to grow. I'd rather measure it in maybe impact uh-huh. or different ways that, you know, it's a continuous test for me to say, like, how does the built environment build impact mm-hmm. and just continuing to test out different projects instead of get bigger projects and bigger teams for it. I just get to have a career of experimentation.
That's so cool. I think we hear that theme a lot.
Yeah.
We don't hear a lot of our guests say, well, I'm looking to hit that 20, right. 30, 40 person threshold.
Yeah.
It's really about keeping the quality.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's been very true across the board for us.
Yeah. And it kind of reminds me kind of again of what Hyun was saying of like, you know, what does growth look like? Mm-hmm. You know, and growth depends on obviously what vertical you're in, what industry you're in, but it doesn't have to be, you know, oh, I need to have 50,000 employees by the end of 2026. You know, it can look like scale, right? I want to successfully scale to a certain point, have the best people doing the work, and be well known for it, and be well known for putting out a good product.
Yep.
So,
and I think from our origins, we just went for a project interview. We don't do this very often, where you know a bigger project or client meets with several architects, understands qualifications, mm-hmm. right? Uh-huh. You do a pitch or whatever. We were coming in, friends were leaving. Oh. And that's what I actually measure as success, uh-huh. because when we started, we heard from many clients, like, this is what we've been looking for, like fresh design from a team that we can connect to, instead of these like big alphabet soup named after a bunch of white dude architecture firms. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so to go into an interview and see another firm that feels like us, feels like success. It means that the market is recognizing the value of that kind of local and creative firm instead of the big alphabet soup firm. And so I think changing our local industry, or you know, it's like Midwest is like a design hub instead of just boilerplate basic.
Exactly. Right.
That's success for us.
That's really good to hear too. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does one go about hiring you? Hiring Synecdoche. Like, are you on this short list now where people, are you accessible? Like, are you at saturation?
Almost everything is word of mouth in some way, for sure. Again, like the interview thing, we're not filling out RFPs for big formal projects and things like that. A lot of it is kind of reaching out and saying, hey, is this the right scope? Mm-hmm. I'd invite anybody to reach out to us, because as much as if we're at capacity, love to do referrals too, right? We have a lot of people that have worked for us or collaborated with us that have started something else out. And we can be like, we know somebody else great. There'd be a much better fit for this. That maybe specialize. We don't do a lot of residential, but we do get, you know, inquiries for those. And it's like, I can point you to three different people if you want a design builder or you need an interior renovation.
Yeah.
Like, I can tell you who those people are, and I would love to see them grow the way they want to as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's one of those things where it's like, you just, architecture, the community's small.
Yeah.
And the more you can reach out and everybody recognizes each other's strengths, it also comes back around. We're all spiraling up.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's kind of a nice dovetail into my next question of, like, talk about, like, the community focus that you have. I mean, I know you've been doing things with your organization, Do Good Work. Yep. There's all of this other stuff. So can you kind of talk about, like, how does your sort of main gig enable everything else that you do in the community?
Yeah. Right. Because it's like, what's your job?
it's more all the things.
All the things. But right. That there's like, you know, how you make money versus how you build a livelihood. Mm-hmm. And Synecdoche is, like, I'm lucky to make a healthy wage. Mm-hmm. But I think a part of it, too, I've hit some very lucky timing. Bought my house in 2012, right? Like, a sort of thing with, like, the homeowner incentives back then. Yeah. Hopefully a lot more of those come back around with policies. So it's like, I have a low cost of living, and so I actually don't have to keep chasing increased wages for myself. Mm-hmm. I do for my team. But that means that I can fold back the privilege I have to have a maintained cost of living back into my community, because I'm stabilized. And so that means doing things for the community, like serving on planning commission, like that was every week.
Oh, goodness.
Ooh. Every Tuesday for 5 years was planning commission, right? And that's without the external prep work and things to go along with it. And you're really putting yourself out there. There's a lot of people that have a lot of feelings about planning and development.
Looking
and
up, like, we're, that. While we're looking up your email.
But I think the other part, and it really, here's a maybe a weird connection to make. Watching sports a lot, especially this summer with the Olympics, like how Flavor Flav invested into water polo.
Yeah.
It was one of those things, like, it was more about seeing this team flourish and be supported to do their best work than it was the alternate is like looking at Wrexham, the soccer team with Ryan Reynolds and McElhenney, and how they invested in this thing because it was like a town culture thing. The town's economy is growing out of that. And simultaneously, they're getting an ROI. And I think in both of those cases, it's sports is like a neutral space. We all come around and rally around something. But that something is culture.
Right.
And I think that is something that design really impacts. And so this whole kind of do good work and coming back to contributing to community, it's like if you contribute to culture, if you lift that up, then everything else folds in. Absolutely. It's not an ad.
Right.
You know, it's like we help facilitate like murals and things.
Yes.
This isn't like a nice, like, oh, now the town is pretty. It's like, no, these are the people that create the culture of our community. Exactly. This place would be bland and no one would be excited to be here if these artists weren't here.
Exactly.
Not their work, the artists, the people part of it. And so I think that's something that we're really interested in. And Do Good Work is just a way to, other than our pro bono effort, allow fundraising and other people to like join the party and help make those efforts happen.
We're going to bring you a giant clock next time we see you.
Lisa, the clock.
Flavorfully.
Oh, snap.
I think I was already a fan, but now I'm really
now
a fan.
A big fan.
Who isn't? I mean, right? Yeah. No, I love that you frame everything that way. That murals was something that was coming to mind as you were chatting. So I was like, these are some of the ways that I think people aren't always aware that design and art affects the community and society in, you know, very subtle but very palpable ways. I mean, how many of us have, you know, traveled to a museum or gone to a particular town just to see, you know, the awesome like street art and, you know, the air quote graffiti and stuff like that. Like these are things that are coming from people within the community. People are passionate about their artwork. Oftentimes they're passionate about their town and like their artwork is a way that they kind of express that feeling and kind of celebrate it with other people. So it's like, I mean, this is part of my ongoing ramble of like, you know, the value of arts degrees, the value of arts and media and creativity. You know, it's not just, you know, finger painting. It can be if you want it to be. But it is also that connection with other people and helping others to see, you know, to have pride in where they live, have pride in their community, have pride in who they are and, you know, feel like they're represented and accounted for. So there's so many like little like psychological nuances to it that I love. And even coming down to, you know, architecture and like buildings that I've been in and, you know, I'll be in a building that's Synecdoche design and I'll be like, I know who did this. I can see this design language feels familiar and consistent. And I love how practical it is. I love how nice it is to be in these spaces. Like, and it makes me love living here, you know?
But you have a design sensibility to pick up some of those things. And I think there are some people that like go to cities like, that was a great city.
Yeah.
I don't know what there was about it. Like nobody's going to be like, this beautiful mural made my sidewalk dining experience amazing.
Yeah.
It was just like there's something about the vibe and it's the culmination of all of those pieces together that create the vibe. And so it's like nobody plays the full part, right?
Exactly.
It's an orchestra. Yeah. And I think that's the big part. Architecture is really complex, right? Like it takes years and a bunch of different trades and skills to put stuff together. Yeah. Some art, you know, it takes one person and if you know a few days, but there is usually a lot of behind the scenes between permissions and financing and all of this other stuff too. And all of that culminates together. And I think that's part of it. It's like you're always working towards something collectively.
Yes.
Your one piece gets to be part of the party.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it's most successful when you can't pinpoint it. Like you said, it's that 99% invisible kind of thing where you couldn't pinpoint what is right about it, but you could pick out what is wrong as soon as you see it.
Yep.
And I think that's the majority of most people. We're not all as savvy as you are.
I'm not that savvy.
Yes, you are.
I just like to look at pretty things.
Yeah.
But no, I love that because it is like, it's the vibes, you know, to use that word. It's like that sort of imperceptible something that makes a place pleasant to be in or resonate with you in some way. It's like, maybe most people might not, you know exactly what that is. But I think for those that are a part of helping to build those vibes, they can, you know, take a little bit of pride in that.
And, yeah. And sometimes it's like the littlest thing creates the biggest vibe and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I think that's too, like anybody kind of emerging into the field. Mm-hmm. It's like, just try out something and see what the reaction is, because you might have the littlest piece of work that resonates to the biggest body, you know, in a way. And I think that's where it's like just putting the work out there. You're going to start to set a tone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to say, what was I going to say? I was going to dovetail into, what do you see in the future for your craft, for your career? Like, something we've talked about, you know, obviously AI is on everybody's minds these days, but what are some of the things that, you know, you see that might be shaping your industry in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years? Speculate.
Something that I've been folding into more, and I know we're also like coming up on November, mm-hmm. but yes. let's dive. Policy.
Right.
So I just joined this year. I got to join the board of directors for Michigan League for Public Policy. Nice. So a nonpartisan group that looks at how policy can impact primarily Michiganders, mm-hmm. To lift them out of, you know, poverty and create an even playing field. And one of the questions is like, why is an architect interested in policy? And it's one of those, it's one of the red tape mm-hmm. figures that, again, projects can only innovate as far as when you hit the red tape.
Yeah.
And even within a project, we've done some where we've found some loopholes and innovated to kind of advance it further than maybe it should. But if you could solve policy as a design solution, that eliminates the red tape for everybody, mm-hmm. that everything doesn't take a unique and creative solution. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is, you know, housing is a big thing, that it's not just about designing housing. It's about figuring out building codes around it. And so we're seeing a lot more kind of European models mm-hmm. trying to fold into our building code as advancement. How we're building those things, mass timber, we're working on a lot. So just building technologies, mm-hmm. mass timber and the building code. One of the 100 years since the last construction method was integrated in the building code mm-hmm. from steel, concrete, heavy timber, mass mm-hmm. timber. So we're like, the advances in building technology is very slow and dumb. Buildings are dumb. But we're getting there, right? So this is where, like, how are we getting energy?
Yeah.
These are all kind of really exciting. Transportation. So I think that there's this weave right now, too, between architecture and urbanism.
Mm-hmm. That makes
that
sense.
It's yeah. a little less separated.
Sure.
And I think all of that really comes down to policy mm-hmm. at kind of local and national regulation levels. We started mm-hmm. the whole conversation with, like, codes and life safety and permits. What mm-hmm. is all of this bureaucracy? Mm-hmm. And the only way to really advance our field is to get involved in policy instead of just be impacted by it.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I'm seeing, or at least investing in the future of the field, is having architects be bigger advocates.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That was our segue into politics without going directly into politics, but you nailed it.
You know, I think it's like politics can be powerful without
supposed to
separate things too, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. Like we're just looking for certain outcomes. How mm-hmm. we get to those outcomes, I think people have different ideas, but
sure.
overall, on the built environment side and making space for people, you want it safe, beautiful, and healthy.
Yes.
And policy is a big part of it.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
What tools, resources, books, things do you use to do what you do?
Just Google. No, Google Docs, spreadsheets. Everybody teases me in the studio that I like spreadsheets, but
we are spreadsheets.
This is spreadsheet season.
You're in a safe space.
Yes.
But all the Adobe products, we're architects are in its own monopoly of CAD software, you know, Revit and those things. I actually didn't like grow into learning Revit. So and that was a decision for me to be like, if I can't learn Revit, I can't get lost in a project. I have to work on the business. Mm. So that was strategically me not learning things. I guess so I could learn other, you know.
I like that though. Strategically not learning things.
Strategically not learning things because, you know, your ADHD, you get tunnel vision and you just want to start doing a thing instead of focusing on what you should be doing.
Tell me about it.
So, but I would say, I wish I could do podcasts more. like listen to podcasts more because I think so much naturally comes out. Podcasts are like going to the library because you stumble upon ideas and books and segments that you're not Googling for the explicit content, right? Like we didn't know exactly what we're going to talk about here.
Right.
Certain things just come out.
Yeah.
So those sort of curiosities I really like. I really like looking at the technology and where those segments are going because there's really scary parts about it, but there's really human parts on the other side to it. And overall, I think wherever innovation is happening, that tendency is going to trickle through all industries.
Yeah.
And so tools, like we're starting to move away from InDesign and the Adobe stuff and looking more at things like Figma because we're somewhere in this collaboration of Miro and
that's true. Yeah.
So like Figma was like more software.
Yes.
It's like as architects, we're making connections and trying to move between ideas, really complex ideas that may have a better user interface for clients.
So. I was going to say, I would add to that, like Figma's been so nice because it's so collaborative. Like it encourages that kind of collaborative design and planning and strategy, which I think some of the Adobe products don't necessarily. Yep. They kind of force you to be in like your little silo.
Flat. Yeah. So like flatten it, send it off, get a comment, come back.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like just having that free flow of conversation and visibility is so nice.
Yep.
So. And yeah, spreadsheets. I feel like you will be the consistent person talking about spreadsheets, Excel.
Understand how to filter and sort, categorize stuff, indexing. I mean, I think Notion is one of those
like Notion,
databases. Mm-hmm. How to do databases because we're just always overwhelmed with information.
Yeah.
Finding a way for your own process. And I think this is especially important when you're starting as an emerging designer. Find your own design process. File management, how you want to save your content, how you're going to make folders and bookmark your stuff on Instagram or wherever, wherever you're saving stuff. I think that's really the most important because we're just consumed with so much.
Yeah.
I think it's less about me having a specific tool versus me having a process that I have the same like named folders in my Instagram bookmarks and my Pinterest bookmarks and my, browser bookmarks so that like, no matter where I'm at, I'm like, I know that like community placemaking is a thing and I can go to all these different things and I'm saving different types of media in all of them. So like my brain is always working in these
categories. You can get to it quickly when you need to and you're not fumbling around your tubs.
Yep.
I mean, what you're talking about, I think is so underrated because I mean, I've been designing for, over 10 years at this point and I'm still struggling just with like building my own personal process. And, as you talk about this, I just really want to emphasize to people who are early in their careers of like, yes, everything that Lisa is saying, like nail your process down, work on that. Don't be afraid to invest that time in what might seem like it's boring, but it's really just so beneficial for you in the long run.
Yep.
So,
and that you can take with you.
Yes.
And you can develop it. It's again, like designing the business instead of designing the project.
Exactly.
And then it just makes you more valuable, like within your career. Cause you're like, I can pull this thing up. I know how to.
Yeah.
And you become the first one presenting something, presenting new ideas or fresh content to connect those ideas together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is one thing that you might tell somebody who's a student right now who's looking towards an architecture degree?
So it's not linear.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thinks it's linear. Because the idea of go to school, go work at a firm, you have to collect these hours, you have to take 6 tests. So it's like taking the bar exam 6 times and all of this stuff. Synecdoche happened while all of that was happening. It wasn't that we checked all those boxes, became architects, and then started this thing. And so I would recommend architect or any other designer, find out what you need like that's out there, but you individually figure out how you're going to get it. Right. So what do I need? I need an architecture license. How am I going to do that? It's not about working in a firm. I'm going to work alongside a licensed architect that can oversee my work to sign off on my hours while I still have a design agency to author the work itself. So creating my how, knowing that there is a very formal getting that what is a big thing. So that's what I would recommend to everybody. It's like, you don't need to have all the answers. Your how is probably like how you're doing things. You're going to trial and error that stuff. Pick a what.
Yeah.
And it, even if the what is, I'm going to be an architect, and then you don't become an architect.
It's fine.
I know a lot of people, Floyd, you know, Floyd Furniture, architects. They went to architecture school and then just pivoted. It was a Kickstarter campaign that went from there. Good friends. Bloomscape, they do online plants. Again, architects. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of entrepreneur friends that completely pivoted, but again, it's about that design process. Mm-hmm. So whatever path you're on, it's the right path. You'll get somewhere cool and creative.
Lisa, that was so valuable to hear. That, thank you so much. That was fantastic.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
If you like this podcast, be sure to heart, like, and subscribe to Cadence wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @CadencePod, or check out our episodes and more at thecadencepod.com. While we are proudly based in Ypsilanti, Michigan, we are recording out of Fifth Avenue Studios in Ann Arbor at Ann Arbor District Library. And we hope wherever you're creating from in the world, you are marching to your own cadence. Thanks for listening.